Hello and welcome to another episode of Agents of Hope. This is episode 2 of my mini-series Understanding Voices. I'm Ella Mansfield and today I'm really excited to welcome Laura Gray to the podcast. I've wanted to have a conversation with Laura since I read an article about gaining a better understanding of girls on the autistic spectrum in educational psychology and practice. Laura was the lead researcher of the project and is here today to talk about her work. So, hi, Laura.
Hi.
Hi. I thought we would start by finding out a little bit more about you and how you came to be interested in the topic that you've done some research on. So, shall we start off? Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yep. So, my name is Laura Gray, and I'm an educational psychologist who's working in South Tyneside. I sort of came to being an educational psychologist in a little bit of a roundabout sort of way. When I sort of finished school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So when I applied to university, I chose a university that gave you the option of choosing three different subjects to start with. You didn't have to choose a major subject until your second year. And one of those subjects happened to be psychology and education. And from there, we were quite lucky. We had quite a lot of educational psychologists who came in and talked to us about the job. And it just sounded really fascinating to me. So that really sparked my interest. And it's kind of gone from there, really. And I think as everybody does, you build up your experience working in schools, working with young people. And I went on to do a research master's in developmental psychology. And then from there got a post as a research assistant, which is kind of where I started to get quite involved in research and was really interested in how it applies to the lives of families. Because I think sometimes when you read research, it can sound quite abstract, and I got quite interested in thinking, well, how does this actually relate to the people that we're working with, and how can we use it to change something for positive reasons for the people who we actually want to work with and want to make a difference for. So when I started training on the doctorate, that was something that I really took with me from that, and I really wanted to try and do as much applied research really as I could. So trying to work out what were the issues that were affecting the children and young people, what schools were concerned about, and how we could maybe start to answer some of those questions through the experiences that we have as educational psychologists.
Thank you, Laura. That was a really good oversight of kind of what you did coming up to the course. So you said that you got really interested in the lives of families when you were a research assistant. What were you researching at the time?
So it was a range of things, really. So I worked in what was called the neurodevelopment and neurodisability team. Mm-hmm. So I worked on a range of projects, but most of them had the common theme of working with children with a diagnosis of autism. Mm-hmm. But alongside that, it was things like working with families of children with Williams syndrome and Down syndrome as well. So there's quite a lot of crossover, and sometimes they had multiple diagnoses. So it was a really interesting role to kind of, you know, think about the unique challenges maybe that some of these families were facing.
So it was sort of, you started work with children who had autism at that point, or were you already working with children with autism before then?
I think when I've been working in schools prior to that, I worked as a learning support assistant as a teaching assistant, and quite often ended up supporting children with autism and, you know, other children with other diagnoses as well. But it always seemed to be that there was always one child in the class or one child at that school who would have a diagnosis of autism. So, yeah.
So it's been a theme that's kind of run through your time before the course, and then when you got onto the course, you're saying that you wanted to bring into it things like the lives of families.
Yeah, I think one of the things I was quite conscious about starting the course is that I was aware that a lot of my research experience was in the field of autism. Mm. So I wanted to branch out and do something slightly different. So I did something slightly different for my thesis, and then kind of came back to it almost again by accident, because it was very much something that came out of practice. Mm. And I think that's what's really important to me, is these are the issues that, you know, are coming out of the work that we're doing. So although this project happened to be something that came out of what I was doing at the time, it wasn't sort of an intention to kind of fall back on that as a research area. But it was quite fortunate in a way, because I did have that background that I had, you know, quite a lot of information really to draw on and experience to draw on. Mm-hmm. From my previous life, really.
Yeah, so it's sort of something that flowed all the way through.
Yeah.
What did you focus on for your thesis?
So I was looking at young people's involvement with social networking sites, really, and what, again, it came very much out of practice. I remember going to a consultation with an EP when I was in training, and there was almost this sense of panic because the young person who was at the centre of this consultation, the young person wasn't there, but all the professionals around them had this panic about what she was sharing online. And I just remember coming away from that meeting thinking, I don't know that it's what's being shared online that is an issue in itself. I think there's something else behind it. And maybe it's the something else that we should be thinking about rather than thinking about the forums and the platforms that these things are happening on. With, you know, it felt like the issue itself was kind of being lost in the sort of panic of, she shared this here and she shared that there, and what does that mean? Mm. It was, to me, I was thinking, well, there's a reason that she's wanting to share this, and maybe that's what we need to explore rather than worrying about kind of the digital side of it. So that kind of drew me in a slightly different direction when I was doing the course. So again, that kind of came out of something that I had been working on in a similar way to this project, really.
Yeah. I mean, that's so nice that it was sort of something that you had experienced and you'd come across when you were on the course. You found that that was something that you're really interested in.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose that brings us more kind of up to date where you are now. So you're working at South Tyneside. What's your role there at the moment?
So I'm an educational psychologist, but I'm also the research lead within the team. I've tried to encourage as much research really within the team as possible, because I think although through our training in the doctorate, we develop so many skills in research. I remember thinking that when I was on placement, and again, this might just be sort of my experience at the time, there wasn't an obvious amount of research going on when I was sort of doing my shadowing placements and things. So it was something that I definitely wanted to focus on when I qualified, to try and encourage that, really. Because I think, again, to be able to be as responsive as we can be as practitioners, we need to know that we've got the evidence behind what we're doing. And it, for it to be up-to-date evidence as well, you know, that the world is changing so quickly at the moment in so many different ways that I think, you know, having the research behind you is really, really important.
So you were trying to bring more of a research base to the things that the local authority were doing at the time. Obviously so important. And I suppose that kind of brings us on to your research and the reason why I really wanted to talk to you, which is that I saw that you had a paper come out and it was about girls with autism. I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about how that research came about. Yeah, if there was any things that led up to that paper.
Yeah, so it was kind of a mixture of things, really. So I suppose a couple of cases that I'd worked on where children had been referred who had a diagnosis of autism, and sort of working with the SENCOs in those schools, and there was a definite feeling of scepticism from the teaching staff as well as from the SENCOs, sort of saying, oh, well, she has this diagnosis, but we don't really see it.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of just took that on board. I didn't really think anything of it at the time. And then I remember a specific consultation where I'd sort of met with the family before and after I'd worked with their little girl. I'd done, as part of that, an observation of her in the playground. And I remember saying, it was almost kind of offhand, kind of said to the parents, you know, obviously I know that she has got this diagnosis of autism. And when I saw her in the playground and saw how she interacted with others, I could very much see, you know, where that had come from.
Mm.
And Mum just burst into tears and I started to panic a little bit because I thought, oh, I hope I haven't said anything wrong. And she said, you're the first person who's acknowledged it. And so just that one sentence of sort of saying, you know, I saw what the clinicians had seen when they gave the diagnosis was such a powerful thing for her, because she obviously felt that she wasn't believed by so many people. So that really stuck with me, that, you know, she'd obviously had this really emotional response to somebody believing her and somebody acknowledging that she and her daughter were finding something particularly difficult. Mm. And then sort of as I went on with other bits of casework, you know, incidences maybe where girls had been excluded for sort of behaviours that you sort of thought, hang on, this could be something else. You know, it might not be that they're just particularly challenging as they had been described, but there might be something beneath some of these behaviours that they're exhibiting that maybe the school staff and the people around them hadn't necessarily thought of. And then sort of as those pieces of casework were going on, I was fortunate enough to be able to go to the National Autistic Society conference, which happened to have a focus on autism and girls the year that I attended. And it was really, really interesting. And there were so many things that were discussed around that were just kind of sparking little sort of memories and thoughts about the piece of casework that I was involved in. And then as a follow-on from that, the National Autistic Society did some online training for professionals around autism and girls. And I did that online training. I think it led us as a team to sort of question sort of our own practices and our own thinking, but also more broadly trying to understand what the awareness is out there with teachers and SENCOs more broadly. Knowing that it's maybe something that has been quite male dominated in the research, you know, is there something that we could do to maybe sort of bridge that gap a little bit?
So it got you to a point where you're sort of starting to think about how you could raise awareness of this issue in the local authority. And so what happened from there?
I suppose it was really the starting point was very much how can we support staff? Because, you know, at the same time that there might be a lot of knowledge and experience out there that we don't know. And maybe, you know, as a team, we need to go to them and say, what are your experiences on the ground? What have you found helpful? So that we can maybe think about the way that we're practicing, or maybe some of the interventions that are being suggested, maybe some of the outcomes and things and reports. You know, are we being relevant enough, or are we sort of behind them in many ways? Or is it the other way around? Is there a gap maybe in their understanding? Mm-hmm. And how can we support them so that they feel that they can do what they want to do, which is to support the girls as best they can?
Definitely. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about how you got started with researching this area in particular.
So we brought together a little team within our service. So there's myself, Sandra Harrison, and then we had two assistants at the time. So that was Ella Bonus and Emma Hutchison Galbraith, who were working with us. And we also had a trainee who was Lucy Hicks, who was working with us. And it was all something that we were sort of interested in generally. So over the summer, Sandra and I had thought, yes, this may be something that could work quite nicely as a research project. And I'd started putting a questionnaire together to get that broad brush understanding, really, of what the kind of knowledge and experiences were of school staff. So we started sending that out. And then it just so happened that Ella, Emma and Lucy all kind of joined the service at around the same time. So they came on board a little bit later. So they helped us very much with gathering the parental views and sort of the analysis of the data that we'd collected, and then trying to kind of formulate it into some some coherent story, really, of what it actually said. So when Sandra and I were putting the questionnaire together, we were very much relying on the National Autistic Society training that we'd done, because they phrased things in such a way that it seemed to make a lot of sense to, rather than reinvent the wheel, just draw on what they were saying in their experience people maybe weren't as aware of or didn't have as much understanding of. So we sort of reframed those really into some kind of questions, just to get that understanding of whether what that was the case, and if that was the case, what did they want from the educational psychology service, really? You know, did they want more training in the area? Did they want something different? And then from there we did the recruitment for parents. Because we thought it's, you know, it would actually be really interesting, because in a way you have the school staff saying what they want and maybe what they know. But again, going back to my experience with that family, it may be a very different experience for the families themselves. And what the families think that school staff need to know, again, might be very, very different from what school staff think they need to know. So it's really to try and marry up those two things. So we went about recruiting for that as well.
So we can assume, I'm sure, by you talking about girls with autism, that suggests that there are differences in the way girls' autism presents and the ways that boys' autism presents. Can we talk a little bit about that? So how is female autism different to typical male autism?
So the way that I've sort of come to understand it, and I suppose other people may have a different understanding, is that the areas of difficulty are the same. So that's why we can sort of pin it helpfully or unhelpfully within this idea of autism. So girls also find social interaction and social communication more difficult than maybe their peers do. Some of them, not all of them, have sort of special interests, I suppose. But with girls, it tends to be more socially acceptable, I suppose. So they could maybe be overly interested in something that their peers are also interested in. So I guess from an outsider's point of view, you might not necessarily see that difference because it is quite subtle. So it could be, you know, around a certain toy or, I don't know, a band or, you know, something like that, that the peer group are interested in generally, but the girl who has a diagnosis of ASD might take it to a more extreme level and become completely sort of absorbed in that interest, whereas the interest that boys have seem to be generally a little bit more unusual, so it becomes more apparent more quickly because the interests that they have go against really what their peer group or just are different to what their peer group might have. So again, although the difficulties, in inverted commas, are the same between boys and girls, it's almost like the way that they're expressed is different. And I think the thing that came through the literature a lot, and certainly through the interview that we did with parents, was the part that anxiety plays for girls with autism. And I think that seems to be based on the fact that they've identified that something is different. And then, you know, everything that they're experiencing, they're aware that they're experiencing it differently to their peer group. And then you sort of have the social interaction difficulties, the social communication difficulties. On top of that, you know, obviously it can cause an escalation in anxiety. And I think that's the thing that parents found was one of the biggest difficulties that they had at home, was trying to understand where this anxiety was coming from and supporting their daughters through it. Because sometimes it could be related to something that seemed quite obscure or something that was quite small. Or would be perceived as quite small to other people, but because of the difficulties around social interaction, social communication, it could have been something that had been misunderstood. And while it maybe didn't come up at the time, so maybe in a school context, it wasn't something that was noticed by staff, the girl maybe brought that home and then really worried about that and really focused on that and didn't know what to do. And then that became this huge sort of source of anxiety. So that was very much a common thread. And I know that boys with a diagnosis also experience a high level of anxiety, but for the girls it seemed to almost be the overriding difficulty that parents felt needed to be addressed by school.
You know, it is so interesting that there does seem to be these differences between girls and boys. You know, the reason why I was so interested in your paper when it first came out is that I had just finished writing a systematic review about best classroom practice with girls who had diagnosis of autism. So your paper came out just as I had finished it, and I was like, oh no, okay. Now I'm have to go and put more into it. And I was just absolutely kind of shocked by how little there was that had anything more than a 50% sample of females. It just like barely existed. And also there was all of this stuff about kind of like the kind of male subtypey kind of thing with autism, and this idea that maybe like there's like two different types of autism, which to me, in terms of philosophy of it, like the ontology of like what autism actually is, doesn't make much sense to me.
We definitely had those questions as well, because you sort of think as soon as you start separating things out into this is how it looks in one group and this is how it looks in another group, then where is the common denominator, you know? And I think we always think about labels, don't we, as educational psychologists, you know, is this a helpful label? Do people want this label? What does it mean going forwards? And that was very much in the back of our minds as well, you know. There's so little research around girls with a diagnosis of autism and those who are maybe going underdiagnosed. How much of that is because historically all of the research was done on males because it was first identified in males, so it was always considered as something that males experienced rather than females? So how much of that was historical and how much of that was just because people hadn't necessarily thought to look? And obviously at the moment there is much more evidence, people are doing much more research in the area and it is coming to the forefront, but it's taken this long for people to maybe think, well, what are these different phenotypes really within autism and how coherent are they, I suppose? And it's the whole idea of things being on a spectrum, but then the spectrum becomes, I don't know, something completely different, doesn't it? Because then you're sort of thinking, is there a spectrum within autism and girls? Is there a spectrum within autism and boys? are they all in the same spectrum? You know, there's so many questions that go alongside it. And then you've got the, you know, some girls who have been diagnosed who have a very male presentation because they've obviously been assessed in a way that historically was geared towards a more male presentation. So then are there boys out there who maybe do have undiagnosed autism, but maybe have a more female presentation of it?
Mm.
And it's a really complex question. And I think there is research going on around that at the moment. But as soon as you start almost scratching the surface, you realise that it's not just one question that you're asking. There's a whole raft of other things to explore.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is a really fascinating area. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, it's, you know, where do you start and where do you stop? What falls under this label of autism, really?
Yeah. I mean, I certainly found that it was very similar when I was looking at literature for ADHD as well with girls. You've got all of these researchers who are saying that, you know, ADHD is a truth. And the same with autism, it is a truth. There is something there that is different to, like, the typical person. And we can find that and we can diagnose it and we're going to call it autism or ADHD. But then you've also got this subset of researchers that are looking at the female subtype and saying, no, actually, all of those, that labelling is wrong because we've noticed that there's more to it than that. At that point, how do you continue to say that there is something that is wrong with that person or like that is different to that person if you're saying that what you've already identified as being wrong actually is not a particularly good labelling of them? Does that fit in with what you found with it in the complexities of literature?
Yeah, I think it is really, really complex, and it does call into question maybe some of the diagnostic criteria that we're looking at.
Mm.
And I know that when I attended the National Autistic Society conference, they had some representatives from the Lorna Wing Centre.
Mm.
They were very much looking at assessment tools for girls because they'd found that when they had girls coming to their clinic, as clinicians, they were thinking, well, we definitely think that she would fit the diagnostic criteria for autism, but the assessment tools aren't picking it up. So is there something different around how the assessment tools are geared? Because we can see from some of the things that this girl is finding more difficult in clinic that to us that would fit with that description of difficulties, but they're not presenting as severe enough, for want of a better phrase, for her to then go on and get a diagnosis in the traditional sort of assessment process.
Mm.
So they were looking at other assessment tools that might be more sensitive to it, to autism in girls, that they could maybe explore a little bit more, which I again thought was really interesting. And I think one of the things that I thought about quite a lot is the subtlety of some of the difficulties that girls have, who then might go on to have a diagnosis, is that, yes, it can be missed because they seem to be able to mask a lot of their difficulties or camouflage their difficulties much better and maybe are more aware that they find things difficult where their peers don't necessarily know why that is, but because they know that there's something different, can draw on some skills to deflect that or to camouflage it so that it's not as apparent. And then again, you sort of think, well, then there's something unique, really, isn't there, around autism and how it presents in girls, because there is this skill set around camouflaging and masking, which from the literature around boys doesn't seem to be discussed, really. You know, is that something that boys do as well? So then again, it comes back to where are we up to, really, with autism as a concept? Because there seems to just be facets of the description that doesn't quite meet maybe some of the things that we're experiencing in practice, and maybe some of the things that the research is starting to find at the moment, that there's these other levels and complexities to it that maybe haven't been apparent until more recently. So yeah, it opens up a whole raft of questions. And then that's before you get onto the topic of, you know, how helpful is a label?
That's a whole other thing.
Yeah.
So earlier you said that it was that anxiety that appeared to be kind of something that was quite kind of typical for girls. And you mentioned masking as well. The anxiety about socially based things and the masking, they seem to be coming from the same root, in that it's more awareness of society and like the expectations of others. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, so I mean, it certainly seems that for whatever reason, there seems to be a skill set there that girls have where they can identify that they feel different in a certain environment than maybe their friends and their peers do. And so they'll conform because that's a way of responding to that. So conforming to rules and routines, or doing as they're asked to do, even if it makes them feel uncomfortable, is something that they seem to be able to do, whereas a boy in the same situation might refuse to do that because it makes them feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas girls, again, this is a huge generalisation, but the girls seem to be able to say, well, yes, this makes me uncomfortable, but if I don't do what my friends and peers are doing, it's going to be really obvious that I'm finding this difficult. It makes me different to everybody else, so I'll just do it. But then that triggers that anxiety response, which is a huge cause for concern when, you know, when they go home, because they may be able to bottle it up at school a little bit and it comes out at home. Or it may be the anxiety that maybe comes across more, rather than staff at school being able to say, oh, hang on, maybe there's something else. It's not just, again, in inverted commas, anxiety. There's maybe, you know, something else going on that we've not thought about.
Yeah, you've said quite a lot that when you're talking about like girls with autism and boys with autism, like you're obviously generalising to kind of like the typical girl and the typical boy with autism. And it reminds me of last episode, I was talking to Cora Sargent from Southampton, who does a little work around transgender children. And my thesis topic is about girls with ADHD. And so obviously I'm looking for participants that are all female and have ADHD. And I've kind of decided, you know, that there will be differences between female ADHD and male ADHD, just as there are thought to be differences between female autism and male autism. And during the conversation the other day, I realised that actually, I'm assuming that all of my participants are going to be, you know, properly female. They're going to be females.
Yeah.
They're not going to have any kind of gender differences. They're going to be that typical socialised idea of what a female is. And then thinking about, you know, myself and my friends and my colleagues and everybody I know, like, you know, nobody is really like that. So it makes it really difficult, doesn't it, to just say that it's just like girls with autism will be this way, or boys with autism will be this way.
Yeah, and we were very aware of that when we were, you know, we thought a lot about it, because I think, again, one of the things that we came across through doing some of the through some of the literature was the high proportion of women and girls who have a diagnosis of autism who also have issues around gender identity. So we wanted to be as careful about that as we could, but at the same time, sort of knowing how society constructs these ideas and trying to make things accessible without dismissing the fact that we are generalising hugely, but being sensitive to the fact that everybody's experience is going to be different. And I think that's a really important issue to think about, really, because it is, again, why would it be that there are more girls who happen to have a diagnosis of autism who also have difficulties around sort of their identity in terms of their gender? And, you know, it's a whole, again, different avenue to explore that could affect our practice. You know, is there something that society has constructed that these girls are maybe more aware of than other girls? Because I don't know. It's just, it's a kind of minefield, really, in terms of where to go with it. But it certainly sticks out in the literature that, you know, more girls with a diagnosis also experience difficulties around their identity in terms of gender. And why that would be is an interesting point to kind of dwell on maybe at some point. But it all comes back, I suppose, to this question around gender and why we're perceiving autism in a gendered way. And it has been perceived in a gendered way from the very beginning, and whether that is just because it happened to be something that was observed in a male and that has led to it being a gendered description, a gendered criteria, but that very much plays into it. And I think that's an interesting thought as well.
I mean, yeah, like you're saying that it's been gendered from the very beginning. You know, like the extreme male brain stuff by Baron Cohen. Is that kind of what you're referring to?
I think, yeah, thinking about things like that, you know, even that terminology, the extreme male brain, and it, in one way it's a helpful description maybe of how some of these difficulties come together and how it's conceptualised. But then if you, And I suppose, you know, this feeds into it, because then if you are a girl who has a diagnosis of autism and you hear autism described as the extreme male brain, what does that mean in terms of how you make sense of yourself and how you make sense of these patterns of difficulties that you're experiencing? You know, it must throw up a whole load of questions. And I suppose that, again, maybe is why society more broadly thinks of autism as a difficulty that boys and men experience rather than as women, because of, you know, the language that has been used historically around autism, and that all of the participants generally in research studies have been boys until quite recently, really, in the general time span of things, and how that affects our perceptions, maybe even sort of subconsciously, when we're going into schools and working with young people, around what you might expect from a certain situation, or, you know, what's how staff respond to that. And I think that's one of the things that we found, is that although staff were very aware of differences between boys and girls in terms of the presentations that they might see in schools, they didn't necessarily know how to respond. Whereas for boys, it's almost like they've got this filing cabinet of ideas that they could draw upon for how to support a boy who had a diagnosis of ASD, or to support a boy who they think might have ASD but they hadn't been diagnosed yet. Whereas with girls, they didn't feel very confident in necessarily knowing if it was autism or not. So therefore, how do they support them, because they're not really sure and they don't really know which filing cabinet to go into to access that kind of knowledge and experience. And then once they'd had the diagnosis, they would draw on all the intervention and support that they had for boys, which for some girls would be very, very helpful. But for a lot of girls, you know, as we've mentioned before, it's maybe the anxiety that needs to be supported. And almost in that sense, how helpful is the diagnosis of autism? And then you do full circle, because actually the label for the girls and their families is incredibly important. But in terms of how you support that at school, it's almost like at the moment, staff go to what they know, and what they know has helped other children and other young people, which is a completely valid thing to do, and something that you obviously hoped that they would do. But equally, is that then missing maybe some of the other things that these girls are finding difficult at school, because they're sort of going the well-trodden path of things that have worked before without maybe thinking, well, hang on a second, this is maybe being experienced in a different way, so maybe the way that we need to respond is also slightly different.
You're saying that, so for the families, the diagnosis was really, really important for them, because then they would have a better understanding of their child.
I think it was almost a recognition and an acknowledgement that these difficulties were real, because the families were certainly telling us the story of they'd known for a long time, really, that there was something different in the way that their daughter was experiencing the world, experiencing school, but they didn't necessarily know what that was. So they just had this almost like niggling feeling that there was something different. And then as things were becoming more and more difficult, because so many of them presented with difficulties at home rather than at school, because they were able to really successfully mask it at school, they had this feeling that people didn't believe them. And I think sometimes, you know, it could be other, you know, going to health professionals and things like that as well, because the girls again would be able to mask their difficulties, that whoever the families had come into contact with, it was almost like, I think the families felt that it was that they were making up these difficulties that they were seeing at home, rather than, you know, because it wasn't seen in the context that they were in at that time, where, you know, another professional was maybe working with them. I think they felt that the professionals thought that the families were making up the difficulties that the girls had. When the girls went on to have their diagnosis, it was a huge relief from what all the families were telling us, because it was an acknowledgement that, no, we do recognise what you're seeing, and we do recognise what you're saying. This is the reason why, you know, it's not all in your head, it's not something that we're dismissing out of hand. There is a reason that this is happening, and we believe you. And that seemed to be the big thing for the families.
It's a kind of, we see you, we hear you kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so you've spoken a bit about Senkos maybe not necessarily knowing how to approach the support for girls with autism, and that idea of not having the right filing cabinet that's suitable for these girls. Do you think there's anything else that you want to add in to that summary of what the Senko's experiences were?
I think one of the things that we found quite interesting was their expectation of what a girl with autism would look like. Mm. So one of the things that they said they would expect would be for a girl to present with challenging behaviour. And actually, when you look at the research behind it, very few girls tend, again, this is a huge generalisation, to have the kind of challenging behaviour that you might see in a boy who has ASD. Because of the anxiety that girls seem to experience, their behaviour is much more withdrawn, quite quiet, so it isn't challenging because they're trying to suppress their feelings around, you know, finding things difficult or feeling different in a certain context. So actually, there was very little challenging behaviour from, you know, from what the literature says. So that was quite a marked thing really for us, that they would, that the Senkos would expect to see that. The other thing that they would expect was to find changes in routine very difficult. And again, this would possibly be something that girls would be able to mask a little bit more easily. So although they found it difficult, they would be able to mask that difficulty a little bit more.
So does that kind of mean that they just kept that anxiety internal? Or was it that they were truly better able to cope with transitions? Or was it that they weren't telling anybody about it? Or is it that they were actually able to cope with it a bit more?
I think certainly from the literature, it would suggest that girls are much, much more likely to internalise behaviour than externalise it. So they're still finding these things difficult, but they're not showing it, they're not explaining it. And I think that's why it maybe comes across at home more, because that's maybe somewhere where they feel that they can start to talk about it, or it feels like a safer environment to kind of express some of these feelings. Whereas for whatever reason, at school, it was much more about just trying to cope rather than, you know, express how you're feeling.
So at home, was there more reports from parents about the girls showing more external anxiety and more external kind of, I guess I don't like using the word symptom, but symptoms of autism?
I know symptoms is not a nice word, is it? But so yeah, the parents were very much saying that they would see the anxiety type behaviours at home. So again, some of the things that you might expect when you're thinking about a child with ASD, so sort of lining up of toys, the more kind of repetitive behaviours, those kind of things would maybe come across more at home, but as a way of managing that kind of anxiety rather than necessarily, well, I don't know, if the two are so intertwined, it's hard to tell. But yeah, at home, the anxiety type behaviours would come across more strongly, and that's where they were becoming more of an issue. So one of the things that parents said was that they felt having a girl-specific approach to autism in school would be really helpful, particularly around their anxiety levels, even if it wasn't expressed at school. So I think that's obviously important to families, but it was very much felt like it was anxiety. That was the word that came up again and again and again in terms of the things that families wanted support for.
Yeah. And I can hear that from what you've said. I mean, so much of what you've talked about is about that anxiety, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you call it camouflaging or masking in your research? Because I've seen it both ways.
We chose to use camouflaging because it is different terminology, and I think they kind of relate to slightly different things. You know, it depends how they're explained, but we mostly use camouflaging.
Could you explain what you mean by masking and whether that's different or the same as camouflaging?
We sort of took the view that camouflaging incorporates masking. So masking is sort of the conscious or unconscious effort to maybe hide some of the difficulties that you're experiencing, so different strategies to adopt that might make a girl with ASD look like she's conforming, where, you know, those difficulties are very much internalised, so although she's conforming on the surface, she's still finding those very difficult. And masking is one of those strategies that she might use to conform, if that makes sense.
I see. So it's the masking is with, it's like a subsection of camouflaging.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's really interesting, because I've never quite known what the difference is between them, and I thought they were just used interchangeably. And that's really interesting. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about what your research concluded in terms of EP practice.
Probably the big thing really in terms of EP practice was what schools wanted.
Yeah.
they very much said that they wanted specific training on how to support girls with a diagnosis or without a diagnosis who may experience these types of difficulties. And again, the parents said that the thing that they wanted from schools that maybe they weren't getting as much of was that specific support for anxiety. So I think schools wanted much more of an overview of maybe some of the difficulties that girls might be experiencing and how they might be able to identify them within their context so that they could put the right support in place and some ideas of what that support might look like. And the parents are very much saying, for us, the support has to be focused on the anxiety, even if it's not being presented at school. It's almost like the other areas of difficulty were secondary to that. So I think that was a really important finding for us, is that maybe when we're going in and working with staff, it's thinking about how to support anxiety in a context where it's not necessarily being explicitly demonstrated, but it is present, and how to support staff in maybe getting their heads around that just because it's not, you know, being shown doesn't mean that it's not there, and how as EPs we might support staff in sort of developing those kind of strategies. And again, it's obviously going to be very person-centred, because every child is different, every young person with a diagnosis or without a diagnosis is different. But equally, I think there is a lot to be said for maybe doing this at sort of a whole class or whole school approach, because I think there's so many children, young people experiencing anxiety anyway, that it could be something that would fit in quite nicely with other things that might be going on within school. It doesn't necessarily have to be, well, these are the children who might have a diagnosis of ASD, so therefore they need this intervention. It could be very much that actually they might benefit from this intervention or this approach more than their peers, but their peers will probably benefit from it as well, especially after the year that we've had. There's going to be a lot of children with high anxiety levels. So yeah, I think it's maybe thinking about the different levels of support that we could provide for schools and how that ties in with what these girls specifically might need. And I suppose the big thing is, you know, the reason that they're camouflaging and masking these difficulties is because they don't want to be seen as different. So taking that into account as well, you know, if you say to a group of girls, right, you're coming out with me to do this intervention because we think you've got or experiencing high anxiety levels, that then may, you know, feed into some of the other difficulties as well. So it's kind of a hand in hand, really.
Yeah, it sounds like there's like a lot of obstacles to navigate with it.
Yeah, and I think it's going to take quite a lot of, because I suppose on the surface it might look quite straightforward, but you know, as we've sort of touched on, there's so many different levels of things that could be causing some difficulty for these children and young people. There's so many layers within that as well, so how we get the support right is really important.
Yeah, when you said it sounds like it's quite simple really, but it doesn't, very simple at all, isn't it? So you're trying to help these girls with anxiety even if they're not showing anxiety, and if you do one-to-one pointing out that maybe they're finding things difficult that other children might not be finding difficult, that could heighten the anxiety and make things more difficult for them, which sounds pretty complex and quite a difficult one to negotiate.
And I suppose what I was thinking was, from a staff's point of view, it might seem quite straightforward, because then if these girls have a diagnosis, it's like, okay, so we can do this for them. And I suppose it's maybe questioning that. It's saying, well, you know, yes, a certain approach might be really helpful, but it's unpicking that. What is it particularly that maybe this girl finds more difficult, and how is the best way to approach that level of support? And it may not be just falling back on the interventions or the strategies that have been helpful before. And I think that's probably really important. And I think, you know, a lot of staff are brilliant at doing that very person-centred approach, and they won't just put children in a specific group because they have a certain diagnosis or a certain difficulty. But I think when things get really stretched and you know, when workloads are increased and all that kind of stuff, it must be so difficult to you know, to try and think specifically for one individual child in a class of 30 or, you know, whatever. And it's being mindful of that as EPs, of how to support the pressures of teaching staff and non-teaching staff alongside that as well, because that all feeds into it.
Yeah, so you're kind of looking at the child's individual needs like with anything really, you know.
Yeah.
And sort of looking at inclusive approaches to trying to support them through some of these interventions, but not falling back on the interventions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's not going to be a one-size-fits-all approach. Mm. And I think that is the big problem, I think, isn't it, with labels, is sometimes it can be, well, this approach works with children with this diagnosis. And sometimes that can become the way that a certain school might help a group of children, and it can be very helpful for some children. But there's always going to be children who it's not going to be as helpful for. And I think you can kind of be blinded a little bit by a label, by a diagnosis, mm-hmm. because it then means that you're sort of put into a category. And I think that's what's come through with this research, is that although the girls have been put in that, in the ASD category, actually the things that they need may be very different from what support is out there already. So actually being put into that category might not be helpful in terms of accessing support at school, because school needs to take much more of a holistic view, I suppose, of what that child needs. I think what we suggested EPs would be well placed to do is be that bridge between school and home, and sort of offer some kind of support before a potential diagnosis and after a diagnosis has been made, in terms of understanding what that might actually mean in terms of the difficulties that children with a diagnosis, well, girls with a diagnosis might experience. And I think it really highlighted that, you know, as I think all of us try to do as EPs, is that working in partnership and how important that is. And I think it also flagged up that it is something that maybe we need to think about in terms of our training when we go into schools and do training, is if we ask to do training on autism, thinking about maybe putting something in there around the differences and similarities in girls who may go on to have a diagnosis.
Mm. So more information.
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose keeping on top of the research, you know, it's a new and developing area, and more things are being explored, and, you know, trying to embed that again in practice and supporting schools to do that.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. From your research, is there anything that you feel could extend that area? Is there anything that needs to be done to further the research that you did?
I think one of the things that we're going to take forward is to try and have much more involvement from families and children and young people in terms of what they want from support and what that would look like and how that might inform sort of an intervention or an approach. Because I think we were quite aware of the two different ways of thinking, I suppose, from our families and from the teachers, and to try and bridge that gap. So to try and bring the knowledge and experience of the families and the young people into what's being offered at school. How that would look as a sort of formalised approach or intervention, I don't know, and I think it would be really interesting to see what that might look like and how that might be embedded in practice.
Yeah, I think that would certainly be really interesting. So, Laura, we're coming to the end of the podcast, and I wonder if there's anything that you would like our listeners to kind of bear in mind as a bit of a take-home message from what you've talked about today.
I think it's probably just to be aware that there will be girls who are experiencing these kind of difficulties in a school context, but it might not be apparent. And I think really listening, and I've lost count of the number of times when I've been working with parents when they say that something is happening at home, but it's not happening at school. And to maybe be particularly sensitive around what that could mean maybe for a girl who might have either undiagnosed or diagnosed ASD, and what that might be saying about how she's experiencing school life, and therefore, you know, maybe we need to unpick some of those things a little bit further. And I think also to really think about the fact that this is still a really developing area of research. So the fact that we found that there was a bit of a discrepancy in the teaching staff's awareness maybe and knowledge about some of these things is as a direct result of the fact that you know, there has been that lack of research. So it's not been something that's been in the domain really, you know, so it's not something that school staff should be thinking, you know, they've been doing something wrong all this time, because it's very much, because it's such a new and developing area, you know, it's not a surprise that there would be that gap in knowledge and understanding. And I think being very aware of the anxiety side of things as well, that is such an important thing for for parents and families that we focus on supporting in school, even if it's not something that's clearly exhibited, and how we can support children and young people with that as well.
So thank you, Laura, so much for everything that you've talked about today. It's been wonderful to have a chat, and I think it's really made me reflect on the kind of topics that we've already talked about on the podcast, like gender and about like the differences in diagnosis. It's been really fantastic to talk to you. Is there anything else that you'd like to say just to end off the podcast?
Just, well, thank you for having me, really. It's been really good to be able to talk about it. My biggest hope is that this research can be applied and can be taken forward in schools, because that's the whole reason that we started out on this journey, really, is that it would be something that SENCOs and EPs can pick up together and think, you know, can we take this forward? Are there other things that we'd maybe be doing for these children?
Well, I hope so too. Let's share it as far and wide as we possibly can. All right. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.